Welcome, welcome, warm welcome, wherever you are. Sometimes it's fun for me to imagine there might be a time in the future when somebody hears this. Even myself, sometimes I want to remind myself of what I've said in talk, so sometimes I even listen to these things years in the future. Whenever it is, welcome. So all of us, whether it's explicit or implicit, whether it's obvious or we state it out loud, or whether it's just kind of in the back of our minds propelling us, we all have some goals, some achievements maybe we could say, or some things we'd like to have in our lifetime. And in Buddhist practice, in the early Buddhism, there's this idea that we can lose the goal of awakening, to be enlightened. And maybe in another talk, I'll talk about some of the wisdom of that goal and how to hold on to it, and maybe how some of the other Buddhist traditions approach it, maybe a little bit different. But putting that aside for now, I'll assume that we all have this goal, whether it's implicit or explicit, to have more freedom, more peace, more ease, more well-being. The fact is that most of us come to this practice because we have a lot of dukkha, we have a lot of suffering, we have something other than freedom, other than peace, other than ease. So we come here and do these practices with the intention of increasing, if not just abiding in wellness, increasing the sense of okayness in our lives. And so we might ask, well, how can we achieve this? More freedom, more peace, more ease. Part of it, of course, is a meditation practice. But how can we achieve our goals? And I heard a talk recently from James Clear, a best-selling author, where he stated, we don't rise to our goals, we fall to our systems. We don't rise to our goals, we fall to our systems. I don't know, that kind of like struck me. Maybe I had a certain resonance. That just because we have goals doesn't mean that pulls us up and helps us to achieve them. We fall to our systems. I haven't read this book by James Clear, so I'm just basing all of this on these little snippets I've heard. So I'm filling in all the details just according to my interpretation. But this idea that we fall to our systems means, in my mind, that when we're under stress or what we do repeatedly over and over, that's what creates the conditions for the outcomes that we're going to experience. So that just because we might have a goal, if we don't have the systems in place that are consistent with that goal, then it's not so likely that we'll meet it. Maybe this is obvious and goes without saying. Maybe I'll also say that something very much that I appreciate about Buddhist practice is that this goal of freedom, and so much about the practice, is finding freedom in the way that we approach our experiences and the way that we frame, interpret our experiences, and the things that we do, things that we say. So we might ask, if James Clear is saying we don't rise to our goals, we fall to our systems, well, what are our systems? And I was thinking about this in terms of this Buddhist practice. Oh, maybe before I do say that, I'll say a little bit more about something that James Clear says. He tells this story, which was quite remarkable, and I'll share it with you, and perhaps you've heard this story elsewhere or already know about this. It tells the story of the British cycling team, and they had hired a new performance director. And I guess the British cycling team back in the 1990s and before hadn't done well, and like in the Tour de France for like over 100 years. They hadn't won it and didn't do very well in the Olympics. And in fact, I think he says that some well-known bicycle brand refused to sell bikes to the British team because they didn't want their brand of bicycle to be associated with this team. So, okay, I guess they're pretty bad. So they hire this new performance director who says, okay, we're just going to do 1% improvement. We're just going to look for a tiny, small, little improvement in lots of different places. So the way the story that James Clear says is they did all the obvious ones, you know, lighter tires and making sure that their bikes are in tip-top shape, I guess, but included things like changing their jerseys to some that are a little bit more lightweight, a little bit more aerodynamic. But then he said that they also made these little 1% improvements in places that you wouldn't expect, such as asking all the athletes to try out a lot of different pillows. And which pillow did they sleep the best with? And then they would take this particular pillow with them when they had to travel to compete. And then they hired some surgeon to come in and to demonstrate the right way to wash your hands. Maybe all of us, after coming through this pandemic, we know how to wash our hands. 20 seconds, warm water. But maybe, you know, back then, to really make sure they knew how to wash their hands to make it less likely that they would get a cold or get a flu. And I guess they have like these big giant trucks that carry all the bicycles, and they painted the inside of it white so that they could see if there's any dirt and clean it all up so that the bikes would always remain clean and not have anything that would jam up the gears, so to speak. So 1%, these little bit of changes in all these different areas. And then the prediction was made by this performance director that they should be able to win the Tour de France in 5 years if they just consistently were making these 1% changes. And I guess this turned out not to be true, that in fact it only took 3 years to win the Tour de France. And then I guess the British cycling team was just a force to be reckoned with and did really well at the Olympics. So it wasn't only the Tour de France, it was the Olympics, the women's cycling team, the men's cycling team. So I just think this is a powerful story, because I'm sure everybody who enters the Tour de France, I'm sure every single cycling team has the same goal, to win. But what systems do they have? So I got to thinking about, you know, what systems do we have in our practice, in Buddhist practice? Some of them are obvious. But one I'd like to suggest are the paramis. And the first, I've been giving a talk, a series on the paramis, and the first is generosity. Just this movement of the heart, and the, maybe the movement actually of the hands too, but to not be stingy, but instead to share, whether it's resources or time or giving people the benefit of the doubt. Part of that's kind of a system we might have in our life, is this movement towards generosity, as opposed to kind of the grabbing and holding on and stinginess. The second parami is ethics. That is to behave in a way that creates the conditions for more well-being, not only for ourselves, but for others. To follow these precepts that the Buddha offered as a way to help support our practice, help support our lives. And as I spoke about in the talk about ethics, that we can use ethics not only as a guideline for how we should behave, but also as a way to, as an indicator for ourselves, of when are we tempted to, or considering to not behave ethically? What is going on in our lives? What's going on in our minds that makes us think that it's a good idea to behave unethically? And then the third one is renunciation. So this idea of renunciation as one of a system that we have, that is, it's kind of the opposite movement of acquiring, or it's the opposite movement of following every single desire that we have and obtaining or satisfying every desire without any thought of whether it's wholesome or worthwhile or helps bring us closer to our goals or is in alignment with what's important for us. So the paramis is one set of systems, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about them. But we could also think about just one way is this idea of systems or habits. What are some of the habits that we have in our lives? And James Clear, he's a best-selling author, and the title of his book is Atomic Habits. And I guess it's been a number one on the New York Times best-selling list for a while. I don't know actually how long, but so what habits do we have? We also have our beliefs. Maybe, you know, our belief that it's a scary place out there or not. Our belief that people are intrinsically good or they're always trying to trick us, or, you know, some kind of our beliefs are also maybe some of our systems, our habits of thought, our habits of interpretation. Also, our intentions we could think of as our system. So we all know that right intention is part of the Eightfold Path. It's the second step. And right intention, that is, you know, what's underlying our actions? What direction do we want to go? And right intention highlights that if we want to have some freedom, achieve our goal of awakening, liberation, more ease, more peace, to have the intention for non-lust, non-greed, non-hatred, and non-harming. Because this recognition that lust and hatred and harming ourselves or others is not going to support our going where we want to go. So, of course, another way that we could say one of these intentions, non-lust, non-greed, is renunciation. It's part of an intention. And then just for completeness, I'll say that also goodwill and harmlessness are the other parts of right intention. So, maybe I'll share this quote to kind of like unpack a little bit what this means, renunciation, because most of us, we hear this word and it's not a warm, fuzzy feeling. We have this feeling maybe that it's going to be about denial or the word now just slips my mind. So I'll just go to the next thing here, is a sutta. Here's a sutta reference, and I'll set it up. That there's this monk who is often, when he's meditating, like off in the woods or in an empty hut by himself, he's saying to himself, "Oh, what bliss! Oh, what bliss!" So apparently he's really happy, and he's just saying out loud, "Oh, what bliss!" And the other monks hear him saying this, and the other monks are talking amongst themselves, and they say, "Oh, without a doubt, Venerable Badiya over here, he must be dissatisfied with the renunciant life, being a monastic, because it must be that when he's remembering the pleasures of royalty, he formerly enjoyed, that he's frequently saying, oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss. So this monk used to be a king. And now, when he's a monastic, and he's meditating, and apparently he's really happy. And everybody else is assuming, maybe because the sutta doesn't say this, I'm imagining, that he's annoying them or disturbing them because he's so happy and meditating. He keeps on saying, oh, what bliss. So the monks go to the Buddha, say, Venerable Buddha over here is always saying, oh, what bliss. And the Buddha says, okay, bring him to me. So Venerable Buddha comes to the Buddha. And the Buddha says, is it true that you're saying, oh, what bliss all the time while you're meditating? And he says, yes, sir. Yes, Venerable Sir. And the Buddha asks why. So here we go. So here's what the Buddha says. Is it really true, Buddha, that even in the wilderness, at the foot of a tree, or in an empty dwelling, empty hut, you frequently say, oh, what bliss? Yes, sir. But why do you say this? And here's his reason. Formerly, as a lay person ruling the land, my guard was well organized. Within and without the royal compound, within and without the city, and within and without the country. So he describes how he was well guarded there at the palace and the city and even in the whole country. Then he says, but although I was guarded and defended in this way, I remained fearful and scared and suspicious and nervous. But these days, even when alone in the wilderness, at the foot of a tree, or in an empty dwelling, I'm not fearful, scared, suspicious, or nervous. I live relaxed, unruffled, surviving on charity, and my heart free as a wild deer. It is for this reason that even in the wilderness, or at the foot of a tree, or in an empty dwelling, I frequently express this heartfelt sentiment, oh, what bliss. Oh, what bliss. So renunciation is pointing to this. A king who has, you know, everything, presumably, that he could imagine, but still didn't feel quite safe. Partly, you know, for having so much is perhaps there's more to lose. But this recognition of the kind of the nervousness or the anxiety that's associated with trying to protect so much. So we might have a lot, but then it doesn't necessarily mean that we have more ease. And we all know this. There's a part of us that know that even we get more and more and more, it doesn't lead to more and more happiness. I've told this story before, but it was really powerful. This was years ago, but had a big impact on me. It was when I had just finished graduate school and was had a kind of like a real job. And one thing that I purchased was a jacket that I really liked. It was one of those jackets that I just put on and I just felt good in it. It fit me well, and I don't know, I just really liked it. It was a little bit too expensive though, but I purchased it anyways, kind of maybe to celebrate, like now I have some income, and I don't remember exactly why, how I justified it then. So I had this jacket that I would like to wear, but then, oh my gosh, this jacket, you know, clearly I owned the jacket, but it started to own me. Oh, okay, I can't drink. I sometimes would like drink, I have a drink in the car with me when I was driving. Like, oh, okay, I can't do that anymore because what if it were to spill and get on my jacket? Or if I'm at a restaurant, a cafe, coffee shop with somebody, and I want to take my jacket off, it's too warm, and I put it on the back of the chair. Oh, then I get nervous. Everybody who's walking by, they might, I don't know, spill something on it or something like this. More and more, this it just became so burdensome to own this jacket, because I couldn't really afford another one. And So you get my sense here. We all know this, that there's just acquiring more doesn't mean that things are going to be better. In fact, simplicity, right, is often what kind of supports the most ease and well-being. There's a reason why retreat centers, residential retreat centers, the rooms are really simple. Really simple, small, simple. There's a reason why the schedule is very simple. Sit, walk, have a meal, do a yogi job. Sit, walk, sit, walk. It's really simple. And I would say for me, this is one thing that I love about being on retreat, is I love just having this small little space, just a few things, and everything is so simple. It allows a sense of freedom, a sense of unburdened, being unburdened. So can we reframe when we think of this word renunciation or relinquishment or, excuse me, we can think of it as a system to support awakening, to support more freedom. We can think of it also as, maybe we could reframe it as non-addiction. That is, we often use this word addiction, whether we have literal addictions, which are serious matters and really bring a lot of suffering to a lot of people. And then sometimes we kind of informally use this word addiction. But these really strong habits that we have attached to behaviors or movements of the mind that don't really serve us. And yet we can't quite stop or we can't disrupt the momentum of them. So if we think of this idea of renunciation as non-addiction, maybe there's a way that we can tease apart and take away some of the energy behind some of this habits we might have that's not supporting us, not helping us, not creating the conditions for more and more freedom. And the Buddha, when he highlighted in particular kind of our addiction to sensual pleasures, that is things that smell good and taste good and sexual experiences, things that feel good or sound good, particular music or things like this. And he was highlighting that our never-ending pursuit of one sensual pleasure after another is not the way to the greatest freedom, the greatest happiness. Instead, renunciation, this way of being able to not follow these urges, these desires that we have. And because it was, in my view, because it was so difficult, it's not something that's so easily done, he spoke about it in so many different ways and different settings. But for now, I'd like to just maybe say a few words about, well, what can we do with, how might we work with this desire that we have for sensual pleasure? Recognize it, it's, of course we have this. It's human to have this, and we might even say we kind of evolutionarily inherited this desire for sensual pleasures, good tasting food, good pleasurable physical experiences. And so it's definitely, all of us humans have this. And one way that the Buddha expressed this or pointed to this was the description of these creatures called hungry ghosts. Perhaps you've heard of them, that these creatures with these really big, empty stomachs, really big stomachs, and then these really thread-like mouths and necks. So they could only get just a little bit of food or sustenance in this thread-thin mouth and neck, and this big belly would never be satisfied. So these hungry ghosts are perpetually always wanting more. In some ways, the human experience is like this, because we understand that there might be no way to satisfy this eternally hungry spirit, so to speak. Yet we persist. We have this, maybe this misguided striving to satisfy this never-ending craving. This force of desire is really powerful. It's really powerful. So what are some things that we might do? One is just to notice how often this pursuit of sensual pleasure is leading us around. What we acquire, what we obtain, what we buy, is it all about pleasurable experiences? How we spend our time, is it all about trying to get that maximized comfort, sometimes at all costs? To be sure, there's nothing wrong with having sensual pleasure. What I'm pointing to is the never-ending, it's not never-ending satisfaction. It's never satisfying. It's never enough. This never-ending craving. So is there a way that we can put that craving, quiet it down, subdue it, and be without it? Simplify things. One is to notice. Another is to maybe respond to some of these urges that we have in a skillful way. When we pay attention to them and to notice, like, oh yeah, I really want that. Maybe we could say, no thank you, in our mind. No thank you. So kind of acknowledging that this urge has arisen, but we're not going to follow it right now. So that could be another way that we might say to ourselves, not now. Kind of highlighting that there's not necessarily anything inherently bad with what we're desiring, but maybe the time isn't right for us. Maybe we don't need to eat more food. Maybe we don't need more clothes. Maybe we don't need that other gadget, gizmo, thingamajig. Or we could ask ourselves, what in this moment is truly lacking? Like what? Right now we might be planning in the future, we need something, but right now, what's truly lacking? Or maybe we could say, this is good enough. It's good enough. Yeah, maybe it would be just a little bit better if I acquired and obtained and got more, but this is good enough. So this is not easy. It's not that we'll do this, you know, five times and then our urges will go away. But if we do these small moments of disrupting this momentum of following our desires repeatedly, these small moments repeatedly, this will make a difference. This is a system that we're creating of not always succumbing to desires, that it creates the possibility for so much more to happen if we're not tangled up in following all of our desires. And maybe just like the British cycling team, we just, you know, it's just a tiny little bit of improvement. Disrupt, not following this desire and then not following that one. We have so many of them. But not in a sense that all desires are bad, but to be skillful in them and to be able to say sometimes, this is good enough. No, thank you. Not now. What in this moment is truly lacking? And in this way, if we can subdue some of our desires, and the Buddha pointed out that so much suffering is linked to our desires, then this can create the conditions for our goal for more freedom. can help create the system in which we're not being pushed around so much. And the more freedom that we have, the more our capacity grows to be with difficulties and to help others, to help ourselves, to bring in the best version of ourselves forward. So in this way, practicing renunciation, we could reframe it as non-addiction, as not following the siren's call every time. Can be, this practice of renunciation can be for our benefit and for the benefit of others. Thank you.